You're listening to Giles Brown on TRE Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain. Madhouse at the end of the earth. The Belgica's journey into the dark Antarctic night. The Belgica set sail from Europe on a sunny day in August 1897 on intent and becoming the first scientific expedition to reach the South Pole. But what happened next was a true life horror story. It is the subject of a new book called Madhouse at the End of the Earth. It's by Julian Sankton. Delighted to be joining me live on the line. Julian himself. Julian, good morning to you.
Well, good afternoon to you. Thanks very much for having me.
The pleasure is all mine. I wasn't quite sure if you were in Europe or if you're in the States, where you actually were.
New York State, upstate New York.
Ah, okay, super. Well, good to have you with us. Fascinating book. For those who may not know about Arctic and Antarctic exploration, at the end of the 19th century, it was, if you like, the version of what we would see in the space race, I suppose, with nations trying to outdo each other.
That's the perfect analog. Yeah, that was definitely the furthest frontier. It was and specifically the Antarctic. I mean, definitely there was a race to get to both poles, but the Arctic had been pretty well traversed at this point, even if nobody had reached the North Pole. There were, in the late 1890s, no fewer than four expeditions at any given time to the northernmost regions of Earth. However, in around 1895, when all the geographic societies of the world got together, for a conference, it had been 50 years since the last serious expedition to the Antarctic, and the societies, geographic societies that gathered at that time, agreed that it was the foremost priority for the world's explorers and geographic societies to explore the Antarctic, that it was basically a void at the bottom of world maps. This idea that there was an area the size of North America that lay all but unknown was something that they meant to rectify. And also was inspired a lot of explorers and a lot of armchair explorers as well. And one of them, one of the people that was inspired by this call, by this void at the bottom of the world, was Adrien de Gerlache, who was a young Belgian aristocrat and who had risen through the ranks of Belgium's extremely bare bones maritime establishment. It was a very odd dream for a Belgian to dream of seafaring, because they didn't have any maritime tradition to speak of, no navy, a bare bones merchant marine. So nevertheless, he thought, well, if the Antarctic is the exploration of the Antarctic is a global priority, why not Belgium? Why not me? And there were various reasons why that was maybe not an obvious idea. And one of them being that it was very hard to assemble enough qualified Belgian sailors to man such an expedition, which is also why he resorted in the end to padding out the ranks with Norwegians and Eastern Europeans. But it was certainly a bold effort, to answer your question, is in line with the dreams of going to Mars that we harbor today. It was, the risks were very clear. Even if the regions weren't well known, it was known that to go there was to risk one's life and to risk not coming back.
I mean, presumably, we're talking at the same time as this, you've got the expeditions into, what would be called darkest Africa by colonial forces as well. It was a national pride thing, wasn't it? Absolutely. And we saw this with the race to the poles, obviously, between Scott and Edmondson a little bit later on. So what was the ship like? And it's the Belgica, presumably.
Belgica, yeah. It was a three-masted whaler, so it was not a particularly new ship nor a particularly large ship. It was I describe it as the runt of the Norwegian whaling fleet. He bought it from a ship owner that ran whaling campaigns in Norway. And so he wanted a ship that was that had experience with navigating through ice. It's a very particular skill, one that he didn't have, and which is another reason he relied on Norwegian sailors. It was outfitted also with a steam engine, which was so in addition to being a square rigged three-mast ship, it also had a coal-powered steam engine. Yes, you're right about the nationalistic quality of it. Even though it was an international, it ended up by default being an international expedition because he couldn't find enough Belgians, qualified Belgians to man it. And those he did find were a ragtag bunch and a notch below pirates who ended up being mutinous. You're absolutely right that at that time, it was any such endeavor would have been couched in those terms. I mean, this was amid a jingoistic frenzy at the turn of the century that would soon lead to war. So yes, that was something that was pretty remarkable. And another thing that I should mention is any Belgian with any kind of adventurous spirit would have been more likely to seek his fortune in the Congo, which was the odious colonial project run by King Leopold II as a personal fiefdom. And in fact, he did ask de Gerlache to come work in the Congo to chart the river system. So the fact that that de Gerlache refused and sought out colder horizons in the Antarctic was also remarkable.
How well prepared then was the ship and the crew for this expedition? Because, you know, with the history of exploration is littered with things going wrong, and a lot of it can be put down to lack of forward planning, if you like. It may be a ragtag, you said, the runt of the Belgian Navy and Merchant Marine. Yeah. And a crew that was made up of Poles, Norwegians, Eastern Europeans, and a couple of Belgians. And again, the sort of psyche that would have marked out any sort of Arctic or Antarctic explorer at that time, they were certainly a different breed. How yeah. well prepared were they as they headed off to the South Pole?
Well, it's hard to say. Obviously they weren't well prepared enough because they were, it ended up the ship ended up being stuck in the ice, and with such disastrous consequences, they weren't well-stocked enough to avoid scurvy, but I don't think it would have been possible at that time to bring any enough fresh fruits and vegetables that would last a year's wintering in the ice. So in that sense, they were well-stocked in terms of quantity, but no food was of the quality that would prevent the nutritional deficiencies that they suffered from. In terms of being prepared psychologically for this, they were not at all, and that's one big factor in explaining why so many of the men went insane, or were mentally destabilized. Two of them went psychotic, and one never recovered his reason. And that's because there was no sense of psychological screenings at that time, which became common practice in polar missions over the course of the 20th century. But at that time, we have to remember, this was the first expedition of what we now call the heroic age of Antarctic exploration. So there was no real precedent. There certainly hadn't been any expedition to have wintered south of the Antarctic Circle. And to do so stuck in the ice was to put men under an unbelievable amount of psychological and physical stress. And I don't think there would have been much of a way to prepare for that today, the way we prepare for that in terms of mission, to try to prepare astronauts or to try to study the effects of long-term confinement and isolation in astronauts is to run simulations, which take a long time and need to be pretty rigorously executed. But more interestingly, to study the polar expeditions that did this first. And in fact, the Belgica is one of the main case studies. The Belgica did not have a similar expedition to study in that sense. So they were, it was it, it, while it's fair to say that they weren't adequately prepared and didn't get the most, I guess, you know, the most psychologically.
They didn't have the experience, and they didn't have the, if you like, the, as you said, the profiling, and perhaps
there was one person who was certainly well prepared, and that was the man you mentioned before, Roald Amundsen. He was the first mate on this expedition, and he had the fortitude, both mental and physical. He was very young at this point, but he already imagined that he would reach the heights polar exploration, of polar glory, and did everything in his power to achieve that, what he saw as his destiny. So he ended up faring rather well, because he expected to suffer, and in fact saw suffering as some form of accomplishment. So, but not all the men were like that. In fact, the man who probably suffered the most on this expedition was de Jourlache himself. While he was a dreamer, and while he should be commended for having put this expedition together, he ended up probably being ill-equipped in many ways for it, and it's ironic that he is the one who decided to steer the ship into the ice as the ice was closing in, as it became clear that that any such endeavor would lead to the ship being stuck fast. He nevertheless pursued that southern course relentlessly, and the ship was stuck as a result.
Why did he pick that course then, knowing that it was a high probability the ship would become stuck? And we talk about the Antarctic, winter was coming in. I mean, you can say, oh, it's a New York winter is awful. A British winter can be quite something, but an Antarctic winter is obviously it's otherworldly.
It's explains it this way. He says that it was there was a storm. He was trying at this point. The expedition had been delayed by a variety of failures, and some reasonable explanations. That they had spent a long time exploring the Antarctic Peninsula, cataloging the flora and the fauna, the geology, and scientists like to take their time. But that goal, the goal of running a thorough scientific expedition to the Antarctic, was in contrast with another goal that de Jourlache had set for himself, which was to reach the South Magnetic Pole, which was on the other side of the continent. So by the time they were finished exploring the Antarctic Peninsula and had to make their way to the other side of the planet, it was too late for him to actually reach the shores of Victoria Land, where the South Magnetic Pole was presumed to be. So he realized that he would have to either return to civilization empty-handed, with nothing to show nothing that would electrify the public, nothing like reaching the South Magnetic Pole or some record southern latitude. And he was afraid of what the public reaction would be, his expedition would be seen as a failure. Or when a storm broke up the Antarctic pack in late February 1898 and opened up leads to the south, sort of avenues of open water to the south into the pack, inviting him in, he saw an opportunity to set a new kind of record, to become the first men to suffer the cruelties of an Antarctic winter. And while he wouldn't have reached the pole, he would be coming home with another kind of precious resource, which is just a great story to tell if he and his men survived the winter. And that was a big if, and in fact, many of them didn't.
Well, I mean, what was the reaction then? They were in the pack ice. Obviously British people will know the story about Shackleton and Endurance, and this is a generation before that, isn't it? And a considerably smaller ship as well.
Well, everybody was against it, he nevertheless pursued the course. He at some point was even falsifying the coordinates in order to pretend that the ship was heading back north, when in fact it was being sucked in further south by the pack, or drifting. And it's kind of baffling to think of this, and I still wonder why he did this, because he kept the engine running, presumably, or as he told his petrified shipmates, it was to be ready in case the pack should open up again and he could return to the north. But in fact, in his mind, it was to be able to go even further south. It was subjecting the ship to incredible dangers, to the pressure of the ice, which threatened to crush the ship's timbers at any moment. You know, the ship was constantly moaning in agony, it was almost a predictable result. It's not like ships hadn't been stuck in the ice in the north before. He knew very well what happens to stuck fast ships all too often. He knew about the Franklin expedition, which lost upwards of 130 men when the ship was gripped by the ice. Or he knew about the Jeannette, which also experienced a terrible loss of life in the Arctic. This is a fate that polar expeditions attempted, did everything they could to avoid, and he did everything he could to pursue. And it is baffling.
What was the, I'm just trying to picture yourself, picture myself as on that ship, stuck in the ice, presumably ridiculously harsh weather conditions. And, you have no idea whether you're going to go out, whether this is the end, and you are cocooned, if you like, in your own floating coffin. I mean, how do people react? How did the men react to that? I mean, and not only that, but then, of course, illness strikes. You mentioned some of them begin to lose their grip on sanity, but there's also, having had seen some of the fabulous photographs that you found, there's the obvious evidence of the bloating of scurvy, for example, and other sort of strange illnesses.
Your floating coffin is a great way to put it. They were, especially as the sun dipped behind the horizon for more than 70 days straight, they were in complete darkness. And the landscape around them was just barren. It was a flat, not entirely flat, but it was just an expanse of ice that the very what looked like land was actually what one scientist described as a parody of terra firma. And so you couldn't trust your step. You could fall through into the ice. You couldn't trust your eyes because the light played tricks on you. It was like they were in the grip of some dark enchantment. In addition to that, the monotony, the fact of, they would become irritable, they would become sort of lose their sense of orientation. And this is something that, many of these symptoms have been described in polar missions since. This is something known as winter over syndrome, is over the course of months of darkness and cold and confinement, men start to, and women, since as women came to take part in these missions over the course of the 20th century, people lose their bearings, and not just the few cases of people who end up experiencing psychotic episodes, but everybody starts withering, both physically and mentally. There's various reasons for that. There's a hormonal imbalance that comes from extended periods of darkness and cold, but there's also a sense of despair. The men didn't know if they would be released by the ice, and in fact, when the sun did return, that's when the serious mental symptoms showed themselves, because they expected that the return of the sun would mean the breakup of the ice, and that didn't happen. So they realized that they would have to engineer their own escape, or at least attempt to do that. That was another remarkable aspect of this expedition, that they thought that this was even possible.
Did they have any communication at all with the outside world? I'm just trying to think. This is presumably...
Absolutely none. Yeah. In fact, Marconi invented the wireless telegraph while they were out in the ice. They were probably the most, I describe them as the most isolated humans on the planet. They were the only people at that time in an area the size of North America in the Antarctic. And they're probably thousands of miles from the closest ship and no way to communicate with them. And even if they had, there was no way for any ship to reach them. And that's even if they knew where they were. And over the skies were overcast so frequently that they struggled to take astronomical bearings. And so they were, as Frederick Cook, the American doctor on board, and in many ways the savior of this expedition, described it. He said, we were as lost as if we were on the face of Mars, which was, I thought, quite a prescient thing to say, considering how much the Belgica is inspiring the idea of or people designing missions to Mars.
It's an interesting one, isn't it? Because you talk about several characters being able to handle it. You know, and you just mentioned that Amundsen, who had become one of the greatest explorer, if not the greatest explorer of his age, expected suffering. So he not embraced it, but it was part and parcel sounds too flippant. But to, you know, great sacrifices were required to have for great discovery. And Dr. Frederick Cook is you described him as a maverick surgeon, but presumably he's logical. He can think positively, whereas the others perhaps are embraced by this romantic nationalistic fervor. And so when it all falls apart and they are stuck looking into the abyss, figuratively and literally, because they can't see anything for 70 days apart from each other. Perhaps those who could divorce their minds and think logically, or had prepared themselves for it, could handle the situation.
Yeah, I mean, certainly a lot of the men would not have passed the sort of basic psychological screenings that are now applied to such missions. But Cook had also, he had been an explorer in the, where he had participated in expeditions in the Arctic with Robert Peary and on his own. So he had some idea of what to expect. But he was the only one with any such experience. And he also was a preternaturally optimistic guy and an unorthodox thinker who could fix anything. He was always tinkering with some problem. He came up with a number of ingenious innovations to combat the mental and physical afflictions that he and his shipmates were suffering from. But a lot of the others were, some of the Belgians that signed up were only doing so to avoid problems back home. Certainly not because they were dreaming or in any way prepared for an Antarctic mission. So these are some of they ended up suffering, but there were one of the men who lost his mind and never recovered and actually spent the rest of his long life registered in an insane asylum in Norway had or at least had some experience in Arctic in the Arctic aboard whaling ships. So it's unclear whether he certainly would have been exposed to the cold and to grueling missions, but even then, the Antarctic is just a different animal. I guess you never know who's prepared for it until you subject them to the conditions down there, and that's.
We won't say what happened next, because obviously we want people to read the story, but it is quite something. One of the things that also stands out is the fact that Cook was, and these are the early days of photography, but one of the things that makes this book stand out, it's a gripping tale anyway, are the photographs that you've managed to source. I mean, you've got what's called Cook's Masterpiece, which is a picture of the Belgica trapped in the ice, and there are pictures in it, and it brings a human face to this story, because you see the cruel beauty of the Antarctic, and also you get that picture of the faces of men who have been stuck together for basically sort of 3 months in the ice.
These are the first, as far as I can tell, and the research seems to support this, these are the first photographs ever taken of the Antarctic, certainly south of the Antarctic Circle. And the fact that they're not only clear, but also but so beautiful and so well framed. And Cook was an artist in addition to being a scientist. They're really gorgeous works. And that's something that I also thought was a remarkable achievement of his, and about this expedition, something that I guess the only equivalent would be Shackleton. Frank Hurley was a photographer aboard Shackleton's expeditions, and his works were also sublime. But that was something that drew me to the story.
That was going to be my next question. I mean, how did you come across this story? Because, you know, I love this period of history, and I love the explanations out of that sort of, you know, because it, as you said, it leads on to the Great Wall. But that whole empire building, and you refer to the dark history of the Congo, etc., and the British had their own problems in Africa as well. I'd never come across this one, and I find it fascinating to find, you know, a young Norwegian, you know, Amundsen as a young Norwegian, because I've always imagined him as the expedition leader through his entire life. Obviously that wasn't so.
Yeah,
how did you come across the story? Did you know about it from a while back?
No, it was new to me as well. I think it's remained pretty obscure for there's various reasons for it. One of them is that it was international, and so the language barrier was a problem. That, you know, much of the source material is in French, but there's also a lot in Norwegian, there's a lot in Polish, in German. I came across it in an article in the New Yorker magazine that was published around 2015, and as it happens, was about NASA's plans for manned missions to Mars and studying these effects of extended confinement. And it began in unexpected fashion with three or four paragraphs about the Belgica expedition. And in those paragraphs, the author evoked the journalist evoked this notion of people losing their minds in the polar regions, which for me was such a gothic detail, and it brought to mind Edgar Allan Poe and Coleridge and Mary Shelley. And so I was, you know, these are all, I guess I was drawn to it from the romantic standpoint, in the same way that de Gerlache was drawn to the Antarctic as a romantic endeavor. But so anyway, that gripped my attention. And when I read that the savior of this expedition was Frederick Cook, a man who is remembered, if he's remembered at all, in America as one of the great frauds of American history, and a man who lied about reaching the North Pole, lied about reaching the highest mountain in America, and was imprisoned for running a Ponzi scheme. He was, you know, a combination of Bernie Madoff and P.T. Barnum. And this idea that he was also a genuine hero aboard this obscure expedition in which people went mad, I just thought that was so cinematic. And so I was wondering if there was a reason that it hadn't been written about more extensively. And I feared that the historical record wasn't rich enough. But as I started looking into it, it was clear that it actually is quite the opposite. It is one of the best most well-documented expeditions in the heroic age.
Absolutely. The book is called Madhouse at the End of the Earth, The Belgica's Journey into the Dark Antarctic Night. It's by Julian Sancton. It's out now on W.H. Auden. Julian, if people want to find out more about the book or about you, is there a website? Are you on social media? How can they contact you?
JuliansSancton.com has a lot of details, and as well as some of the photos that you described. So that would be a good start. I'm also at J Sancton on various social channels.
Only the question I'm going to ask you next is, have you been to the Antarctic? And if not, is writing something like this, would it make you want to go and tread on those ice floes and discover that continent?
I have been to the Antarctic. In fact, you know, I felt it was necessary to go there to be able to, you know, render this environment in three dimensions, as it were, to describe the sights and sounds and even smells in a way that I wouldn't have been able to if I relied only on the diaries or the black and white photos. I traveled there in the end of 2018, and spent a week in the or along the Antarctic Peninsula, in an area that is now named after the commandant of the Belgica. It's called the Gerlache Strait, which is just a sublime part of the earth, almost alien in its beauty. And I feel like that greatly informed the book, especially the passages about that area. One thing that I was not prepared to do and was all too happy to rely on the diaries to describe was the wintering in the ice. I was not going to subject myself to that, but I was stunned by the extent to which the area that I did visit seemed not to have changed at all in 120 years. I even recognized facets of the landscape from Cook's photos. And of course that was, it has changed dramatically in various, in subtle, but consequential ways, because of climate change and that delicate ecosystem is gradually breaking down, but it was still just a phenomenal experience. And I told myself that the penguins I was seeing and the seals that were waving at me as our ship was floating by, told myself that they might have been the descendants of some of the same animals that the men of the Belgica would have seen.
Very probably. And I suppose at a time when we've all been sort of locked down in isolation and forced to stay in and stay safe, I suppose it puts it in perspective what the crew of the Belgica went through.
Certainly does. Yeah. I mean, we, when you think of how stressful and traumatic this experience has been for many of us, to say nothing of those who have lost loved ones, imagine, experiencing that without Netflix, and instead of baking bread, you'd be eating raw penguin, and there's no guarantee that you'll ever, be able to leave this ship. It's no wonder so many of them lost their minds. And I think that was something that I was almost done writing the book when the pandemic hit, but I did immediately feel an empathy for these men that I hadn't before.
The book is called Madhouse at the End of the Earth. It's out now on W.H. Allen. It's by Julian Sancton. Julian, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you today.
Oh, the pleasure was mine. Thanks for having me.